Hello and welcome back, Podheads, and welcome to another episode of Over My Dead Pod. This is your host for today, Kate Carter.
And I'm Holly Spear.
I feel like we just need to say the Podheads is now our fan club, even though we said that last week. Maybe you skipped the episode, but that's what we're going to call you guys today. Not our fan club, but like our listeners.
Our fan club.
I mean, sure, if you guys want to be a fan club.
You guys want to join a club.
Yeah. We'll do it. We'll get t-shirts made. And it's just Holly and I today. Unfortunately, Kylie is sick. So she had to take a day off, which, you know, is fine. Whatever. And Holly, I can't believe that I'm saying this, but I'm doing an unsolved case.
Ooh.
And I'm frustrated that I even did this to myself. But I think at the end, you'll kind of see why I ended up choosing this case.
Is it one of those cases that's unsolved, but not really unsolved?
I ain't telling you shit. All right, so let's get started. To set the scene, we're going to go back to the 1980s. So it's 1985 in Ina, Illinois. Never heard of Ina, and that's because it's a super tiny town, like tiny. It had 500 people in it in 1985. So like, I don't even know how that's a town.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a suburb.
Yeah. Like I've never heard of something that small before. So basically everybody knew everybody. Our story is going to be revolved around Keith and Elaine Dardeen. So the Dardeen family. And they had just moved to Ina with their 2-year-old son named Peter. So Keith and Elaine were pretty young. They were 29 years old and 30 years old. So my age and Cameron's. And they had moved from another small town to Ina because of Keith's job. He apparently worked at a water plant that was in the next town over. And so a lot of the employees just lived in like the local community. And I assume whatever his job was, it bounced him around a lot because it seems like they just moved every few years. So as soon as the Dardeens moved out to Ina, the family bought a mobile home that they were able to rent this large piece of property to put on it. And surrounding the home was basically just woods and railroad tracks. So very remote. Everything was not nearby. Like your neighbors were far. Their closest neighbors were actually their landlords named Lloyd and Joanne, who had a farm that was like within a mile distance. So that tells you something. While Keith worked his water plant job in the next town over, Elaine ventured out into town to find a job but had no luck. So she searched the next town over in Mount Vernon, which was about 20 minutes away, and ended up working at a Staples. Other than that, the Dardeens were pretty religious. They belonged to a local Baptist church and happened to be in the church's band as well. Pretty much as soon as they moved to Ina, the family became pretty popular with everybody. I mean, it's such a small town. So if it was like, I don't know, but I'm just saying, if Ina was like, it was a church community and these people were young, they were super active in church, they were like the new people in town, I mean, they're going to be popular if they're nice, you know, like people's going to want to talk to them and whatnot. Yeah. So basically everyone in the town loved them and their son, Peter. At some point in 1986, so the next year, they were living there for a year and Elaine became pregnant with her second kid, which was planned and very exciting. And at this point, they decided that they wanted to start saving up money for their children and their future children's like future and college funds. So basically the two of them, anything they made income wise, if it wasn't going towards their property or food, they were putting it in a separate kids' college fund, which is super cute. But also I'm pretty sure they were like Keith and Elaine were pinching pennies. Like they were making the most minimum of salaries. So it kind of tells you how nice of parents and people they were for going ahead at 2 years old and unborn to put money away for college funds. And when Keith found out that Elaine was pregnant, he decided it was time to like put some security measures into place at their property. Not really sure why this didn't happen before, but maybe he just now was like, we're going to stay here for a little while. We're building our family. Like I'm going to get out and put cameras up or something. I don't know. But so basically each night after their son, Peter and Elaine would go to bed, Keith would always take a walk around the trailer outside to make sure everything was good. And then he would double check that all of the windows and the doors were locked, which not a bad idea. And I'm not sure why this started happening. Like it kind of started right as the pregnancy was announced. So I assumed it was just because of the pregnancy, but we don't know if like maybe something had happened and he started doing security measures. But oh, not to mention too, the Dardian family had this rule before they moved to Ina, like their families knew this, that basically they didn't answer the door for anyone they didn't know, which is smart. And then they didn't answer the door unless they knew someone was coming over. If anybody just came over without notice, it turns out like the Dardians wouldn't even look at them through the door. They would just ignore them.
I don't think that's that weird. I feel like I hate answering the door when I don't know who it is. Like, you know, when you were a kid and somebody would knock on your door and you'll like hide in your house yeah. and you're not there. Like as an adult, I feel that.
Well, I don't want to talk to people I don't know, but anytime someone, I will say I'm the kind of person, like if somebody knocks on my door and I don't know who they are, I'm going to answer it because I always think the worst. I think something's wrong. Something important to mention as well. The Dardians lived in a town called Mount Carmel before they moved to Ina. And that's where Keith was born. That's his hometown. And his parents still live there. So like they had family that were at Mount Carmel, which wasn't too far away, but it was still a drive. And so when Keith and Elaine found out that she was pregnant again, they basically, even though they had only been in Ina for a year, they basically made this plan of like, we're going to move back to Mount Carmel. Like, we don't want to raise children in the middle of nowhere with nobody here. Keith's parents knew this. So Keith's mom is named Joanne, and she'll be in the story for a little bit. But he told his mom that they regretted moving to Ina and that they felt unsafe in such a remote area. And not sure why he said this again. Like, I don't know if something happened, but it's pretty important to note. Like, if I told my parents, like, hey, I feel unsafe where I live, they'd be like, and you're gonna, like, you need to move tomorrow, kind of, you know, they'd tell you to leave. Let's talk about Ina, Illinois. So it's in Jefferson County and pretty tiny county as well. In 1986, so I'm gonna give you some numbers, Holly, but I'm gonna break it down for you because I want you to understand how small all of this area is. In 1986, Jefferson County had only 5 towns. When the Dardians moved to Ina, within the next 2 years, there were 15 murders that had taken place within that county.
Oh my goodness.
And it's such a small county. So like, that's a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's in what time span? Within a year?
2 years.
2 years.
But within still 5 towns.
Yeah, that's still a lot. Yeah.
That's a lot. And then to kind of make it a little bit worse, 2 of those murders were different cases, but rape and murder of elementary school girls. So you know, they have little kids. I'd freak out if that was like the next town over had happened. I'd probably move too.
Imagine it's so small and there's like no people.
No, like I tried to look up like, where's the closest police or fire station? You know, like if they had to call 911, how long would it take for someone to get there? Couldn't find it, but I assume it's just a really remote place. When they had moved it there in 1985, it was only 3 months later when the first girl, the elementary school girl, she was 10 years old and she was raped and killed in the next town over. So what a welcome. Peter, their child, was only a year at this point. So that would basically just freak me out. And then 5 months after moving there, a man murdered his entire family after he tripped on LSD for the first time. And he killed his father, his mother, and his 3 sisters. And that was on the same street that the Dardians lived on.
Okay. So I would be thinking about how I was going to get the hell out of there.
Yeah. I mean, regardless of the criminal history, Keith basically always had the security measures in place, but now he was more paranoid than normal, which I obviously would too. Other than leaving the trailer for work, they pretty much stayed inside, kept to themselves, other than going to church. Some of Keith's coworkers would later say that Keith, around the 1 year mark, started acting a little odd and saying that someone was watching him. But again, we have no idea what this was from. And I don't, you know, he maybe just got that feeling. They planned on a move back to Mount Carmel before she gave birth, and they did all the necessary things. Like, they put up their trailer for sale. They told their works about them, the pending move, basically. Elaine was due to have her baby at the beginning of February. We are now going to be going November 17th. Okay. So this is while she's still pregnant. She's about 7.5 months pregnant in 1987. And Keith had been scheduled for an overnight shift at the plant, but apparently he never showed up for his shift. That's something that had never happened before. In fact, he was always early for his shifts. He would often cover shifts for coworkers. Keith's boss at the plant was pretty much alert right away for not showing up. And his boss began calling Keith's house in Ina, but no one answered regardless of how many times he called, which also set another red flag off because it was dinner time at this point. And so you would think Elaine and Peter would be home.
Right.
You know, it's dark outside. He's 2 years old. She's pregnant, blah, blah, blah. Apparently at work, Keith had one of his emergent contacts listed as his mom. So his supervisor also called his mom in Mount Carmel to see if they knew where Keith was, but they obviously didn't. And they didn't know why he didn't show up for work. At this point as well, I think was in within like an hour, everybody kind of started to piece together that they couldn't get in contact with Elaine either. So Keith's dad decided to call the Enos Sheriff's Department and ask them to do a welfare check, which I want to say too, I feel like people kind of not shit on welfare checks, but if you think a welfare check needs to happen, call for a welfare check. You know, like I think it's more important than what people do. Like they kind of save it for high, you know, stake cases and stuff like that. But if you're not able to get in contact with people and it's suspicious circumstances, stuff like that, it's cool to do. I feel like the police are okay with doing that.
Yeah, it's like what they're there for. And usually everybody's fine, but you might as well go ahead and be safe than sorry.
Yeah. And so Keith's dad, his name's Don, he ended up driving to Ina from Mount Carmel to accompany the sheriff's department to their trailer because he had a spare key to their house. So he was like, you know what? I'll just let them in. Like if nobody answers, I'll just let them in so they could, you know, look around.
Another thing is I don't think that when you do, well, I'm pretty sure unless there's reason for the police to go inside.
Yeah.
They can only, all they can do is knock on the door.
I think you're right. And so in this situation, I'm thinking like, obviously his dad was like, they can come in. I'm giving them the key, but pretty much he would just be able to open the door and they'd be able to see inside.
Yep.
Yeah. So around 6:30 PM, Don and the sheriffs met outside the Dardine trailer. They all called Keith and Elaine. They knocked multiple times on the trailer door, but they got no answers. So the sheriffs then started walking around the property, like behind the trailer, in the field, near the woods. And at some point, one of the sheriffs started shining his light through the trailer windows to see if he could find anything or see anyone. And once he was at the back of the trailer, he was shining the light into the main bedroom, and the sheriff saw people under the blankets in the family bed. So he started knocking a few times. But he assumed they were sleeping. Like it wasn't anything that looked super suspicious, but it was 6:30. And so that kind of threw him for a loop. So he started banging on the window and the people did not move. At the exact same time, the sheriff that opened the front door with Don, the dad, they open it. It was unlocked. They didn't need the key to get in. They pushed the door open and the sheriff was able to see inside the trailer. And what he found was absolutely horrific. Trigger warning. Tucked in neatly underneath the bed covers with their heads sticking out as if they were sleeping was 3-year-old Peter Dardine. And next to him, a tiny, tiny baby.
Oh, no.
Next to the bed was Elaine. She had been gagged and bound with duct tape, which Peter had also been gagged and bound with duct tape as well. And to make things worse, both Peter and Elaine had been bludgeoned to death with a baseball bat that was laying on the floor covered with blood. They were bludgeoned so bad that both of their heads were caved in.
Gosh.
But it just gets worse. Next to Peter's lifeless body, also tucked neatly under the bed covers with its head sticking out as if it was sleeping, the sheriffs found a tiny little baby. Elaine, who was 7.5 months pregnant at the time, had apparently gone into labor while being attacked and had given birth to her baby girl. And that baby girl was lying in the bed next to Peter. The baby had also been bludgeoned to death.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah.
That's horrific.
And it's all horrible, no matter which way you put it. And not that it really matters, but no one really knows if Elaine went into labor while watching everything happen to her son, or if it was happening while she was, you know, getting beat as well. But she went into premature labor. I mean, 7.5 months and you naturally going to labor, like, does not happen.
That's
absolutely crazy. All three of the Dardines had been killed from blunt force trauma from the baseball bat. After investigating, there had not been any forced entry into the house. Both Peter and the newborn had not been killed in the bed, but placed there afterwards. There was nothing missing from the house, and Elaine had not been sexually assaulted in any manner. So if you ask me, it ain't a robbery, obviously. You know, it's not like a robbery gone bad. But the way that they were killed and placed and what happened sounds pretty fucking personal.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you don't go in and rob a house and then bludgeon the family members to past death and then tuck them into bed.
Right.
It's not something a robber does.
No. So it's my, right away, my thought was like, whoever did this knew the family and the fact that the front door was unlocked. Because we know that they had their rules of like not answering the door unless you knew who it was.
Yeah, either they knew who it was or they knew how to get inside.
Yeah. And then they also, investigators were pretty much right away able to see that the trailer had been cleaned after everything happened. They were able to find blood around the trailer, but it was not like pools of blood. There was no blood on the bed, even though the kids were killed. Like they had really taken their time. So that also kind of tells you that whoever did this was not in a rush because they took the time to clean up everything, which is always nuts to me when murderers don't, they're not in a rush and they like tidy stuff up. I'm like, dude, you're super casual for doing that.
Well, and also think that that adds an element just for the argument that they knew whoever it was, that they knew the family, because they would have had to know that no one was coming over within that time period so that they could clean and time.
But with all that being said, Keith was nowhere to be found. In the driveway to the property, normally there would have been two cars, a red car and then a silver truck. And when the sheriffs and Keith's dad, Don, arrived, the red car was missing from the property and the truck was there. So right now it's kind of like, you know, the first thought is obviously going to be like Keith skipped out on work. So Keith is nowhere to be found. He's not at work. The car is gone. His family is killed. It's Keith, you know, and rightly so, as all should be investigated kind of thing. It's very common and it doesn't help that Keith's just nowhere to be found.
Yeah.
So the police immediately start searching for Keith. They put a warning out saying that Keith is actually wanted, which probably wouldn't do that anymore, but I don't know how they were, whatever. And they put up roadblocks throughout the town and the surrounding towns to see if they could find that red car. While they were looking out for Keith, investigators went to Keith's parents' home in Mount Carmel just to ask some questions and do the preliminary like searches as well. Following day, November 18th, Keith is still nowhere to be found, but the police did find the red car. Apparently, throughout the night or early morning, the police found it parked outside of a local bank that was 15 minutes from the Dardines' home. The interior of the car was completely covered in blood. Wasn't trying to clean up the car.
Yeah.
Clean the trailer, but not the car. Police assumed that this meant Elaine and Peter were most likely killed in the car and then transported to the home afterwards. But they don't know if maybe that was Keith's blood or maybe Keith wasn't injured at all kind of thing, but Keith was still nowhere to be found. So at this point, they don't know what had happened, what's in the car except for blood. They don't know whose it is.
Yeah.
A few hours after the car was found, as we hear in a lot of stories, there was a group of hunters walking through a field near the Dardines' house, and they found a body. It was Keith's. Unlike his wife and children, Keith hadn't been beaten, but he was shot 3 times in the head. He was also castrated. And then to make it a little bit worse, I don't even know how to say this, but he was castrated and then it was put into his mouth. So, and that's how he was found. Shot 3 times in the head, castrated, shoved into the throat. And I mean, that just keeps showing me that this is like a personal case.
You know? Very. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause that's not normal at all. Field that Keith's body was found was about 10 minutes from the home, kind of near the bank a little bit. But once again, completely rural area. So, you know, everything's pretty far apart.
I definitely thought that this was going to be a husband situation as usual.
Per norm. So if we had to guess what happened, personally, I think that the killer, because in this situation, I think it's just one person. I think it was someone that they knew had beef with Keith for some reason. Like, I think definitely because of the castration thing and he was killed somewhere else. I think like Keith was the issue. I think they met up or he saw him. They went back to the trailer. The person killed Elaine and the kids and Keith watched. And then they killed Keith in the field, you know?
Like, dude, this is wild though. Like, what kind of beef do you have someone with someone to be the answer?
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy.
And the fact that it was done in multiple places.
Yeah.
You know, like Keith had left for work that night, but never arrived to work. So was it somebody at work? You know, like, did he ever make it to work? It just doesn't, it makes no sense. But to play devil's advocate on what I just said, the police didn't find any DNA evidence that was tied to the killer. So there was nothing in the trailer. There was nothing in the car. There was nothing in the field. I mean, I don't know how you would kill three people, four people, bash their heads in, and not have any DNA, any of your DNA evidence. That then makes me think maybe Keith was killed first, and then they, I don't know. Like, it's just a weird situation. I just think it's kind of shocking when there's no evidence found at crime scenes. I always just think that's so weird. Like, the person just was either really good at doing their job, or they just got lucky, you know?
Yeah, but it's rare.
Yeah. So after all four bodies were autopsied, nothing much else was found that the police investigators didn't already know. All of the family members all of the family members in the house died of blunt force trauma. And then Keith died from the gunshot wounds. And they weren't really able to determine who died first. All that they could see is that they had all died within 1 to 2 hours of each other.
Were they able to tell what they were killed with, the family members that were killed with blunt force trauma?
It was the baseball bat.
Okay, okay.
Which was still in the trailer, but had no, like, fingerprints on it. So obviously, this really shook the Ina community, you know, this young couple. Pretty much everyone knew everyone. And like I said before, the Dardines were religious, active in their church. So you can really kind of only imagine the aftermath of the murders. It seemed like pretty much everyone within a 15-20 mile radius heavily mourned the Dardine family.
Yeah.
And especially the whole fact of the baby. I mean, that's
disturbing on another level.
Pictured it in my head. And I was like, I didn't look up pictures for this case. And I normally do, but when it has to do with babies, I really struggle with that.
Well, yeah, that's.
Or dogs.
Yeah. No, we don't go there.
No. Not on this podcast.
Not here.
To make things just worse in general, like, the police had no leads. There was no evidence. There was nothing for them to go off of. They interviewed as many people as possible. Nothing came up. At some point, a local news station put up a reward for information leading to an arrest in the case, which I found to be really big, because when do you ever hear that a news station did, you know, like, it's normally family or friends.
Yeah.
But it was the community. Like, they rallied together and pulled money, and it was $10,000, which is pretty good for 1987. Yeah. And then as the months went on, the family was able to put up money. People donated more in the community. So in total, I don't want to say that part because it will kind of spoil things, but in total, it was $68,000. So with no leads in this case, police still tried everything to figure out, like, who did this. They followed up with every single tip they received. They interviewed about every damn person possible and every person in the town. At some point, the investigators did talk to the Dardines' landlords, who were their neighbors. And that's when they found out for the first time, they hadn't heard it from anybody else, but that the Dardines had been breeding Labrador retrievers. And the neighbors had seen people go in and out of their trailer on multiple occasions, like, that were obviously strangers, to come pick up the puppies or whatever. But one man in particular stuck out to them because of how he acted. And all I want to say, they were able to say to the police too, is that this man acted strangely and they thought it was strange. But, like, what the hell does that mean?
Yeah. Some detail would be nice.
Right. And you say that also, if you see people coming in and out and one sticks out to you, that's probably not a good thing.
Yeah, no, you know? He had to have done something.
Yeah. But unfortunately, I mean, the tip went nowhere. So we go years past with no answers. And at some point the police did name two different suspects in the case. So we're going to dive into those suspects. The first person's name was Angel Resendez, who was also known as Rafael Resendez Ramirez, a.k.a. the railroad killer, a.k.a. a serial killer.
Okay.
Yep. So I looked him up because I was like, wait, railroad killer sounds kind of familiar. We haven't done him. We could, though. So just throwing that out there. And he was an American serial killer in the 80s. He had been suspected of killing up to 25 people. Rafael traveled up and down and across the U.S. on freight trains. And he would stop in different towns and kill someone and just pretty much hop on the train and go off to the next town. know, so, and the reason that the police thought Raphael could have been the murderer is because of two things. First of all, the Dardines lived right next to a train track, and they lived next to a stop too. So like the train would be stopping in and out, like where their house was. And then two is Raphael's choice of murder weapon was beating his victims to death with something that was owned by them. So like he didn't carry a gun or a knife. It was just who the people would die with whatever was laying around them, basically.
Like an opportunistic killer.
Right. Yeah. So Raphael was eventually caught and arrested in 1999, and he was charged with the murders that he was connected to. But unfortunately, the Ina police were never able to find any evidence that Raphael had actually done it. So the second suspect, this guy is named Tommy Lynn. And this Tommy dude, his story is nuts. So we're going to talk about his story. I'm going to take a little break for our Dardine family story, but it's all going to kind of wrap together. We're going to talk about Tommy. Tommy Lynn was born in Oakland, California in 1964. He had a twin sister named Tammy, Tommy and Tammy, and he was one of six kids. When Tommy and Tammy were about a year and a half old, they both contracted meningitis, and Tammy ended up dying from it. So he basically, he didn't have a twin the rest of his life. Tommy's childhood was pretty horrific. He, as a baby, he was shipped off to his aunts to live while the other siblings stayed home with the mom. And then when he was five, he went back to his mom and dad's. And at 7 years old, he began drinking every single day. He began
old?
7 years old, people.
Seven. Okay. Seven.
So he would later go on to say that he started drinking every single day. And that at some point within the next year, so 8 years old, he met a man named Willis Clark through his mom. Who his mom was an alcoholic, by the way. That's where he got.
Yeah, I was just about to say that's a parent problem when you're drinking at seven. Like that's right.
So Tommy met this older man through his mom as one of his mom's friends. And apparently Tommy and this older man, Willis, hung out every single day. And this older man started molesting him. To make it worse, Tommy's mom knew about the molestation, but continued to encourage Tommy to hang out with him every single day.
Prison.
So that kind of makes me think that this older man had something to do with his mom, like maybe supplied her with stuff, like gave her money, you know, because what? She was basically pimping out her son.
That's sickening. Okay.
Horrible. When Tommy was in fifth grade, that's when he began using drugs. And for one reason or another, because of his alcohol and drug use, one day, he's in fifth grade, one day his mom and his siblings packed up, left town, didn't tell Tommy, and he came home to an empty house.
That's so sad.
They just left him. A few days after his family had left him, Tommy walked down the street from his house and shot a woman, assaulted her, and ran off.
And now how old is he at this point?
This is still 10, right when the family left. This is when shit started to like his life was awful, and now it's catching up to him. Fortunately, the woman survived, but that pretty much sparked the beginning of Tommy's violence. You're going to love this part. The family moved to Little Rock, Arkansas.
Woo-woo. Oh, gosh.
Woo-woo. And Tommy made his way from California to Arkansas via trains and hitchhiking when he was 13 years old. So it took 3 years. He finally made it to Little Rock. I don't know how he found this out, but he found his family's home. Didn't announce himself, just walked through the front door while all the other kids were at school. His mother was home by herself, and she was in the shower, and he went into the shower, started to strangle her and rape her. After that, he walked out the front doors and never saw any of his family members again.
Dude, that's insane.
Is that not great? Like,
yeah, no words, honestly.
Yeah.
It's so hard when you like feel for a kid. You're like, that's so sad that his life was like that. And then they grow up and it's,
you're a monster.
You feel bad for them, sorry for them. Like,
yeah, that all occurred. Afterwards, Tommy traveled throughout the U.S. as a nomad, basically nomad for about 20 years. And he was by himself the whole time. You know, he didn't have family, didn't have a partner. At some point, he joined a traveling circus. Love it. And he was able to move around to different towns with them. So this is when he took the opportunity that he was going to be in tons of different towns. That he would start killing people. It was a great cop out for him because he would kill someone. He would never get caught. because they would leave the next day. There was no trace. And that's how it worked. So for over two decades, Tommy went on to kill around 22 people.
Wow.
Almost all of his victims were females. Of the males that he did kill, he had shot them. Of the females that he had killed, they had all been sexually assaulted and stabbed or strangled, but all of his victims ended up being bludgeoned to death. So, like, regardless if the males had been shot, regardless of how the women had been, you know, strangled, they all were bludgeoned.
So no kids, just men and women.
The way that Tommy ended up getting caught was because of his first two kids that he went after. And this is when the police found out about him being a serial killer. And this attack was pretty awful. So it's New Year's Eve, 1999, in Del Rio, Texas. A 10-year-old named Crystal was having a sleepover at her friend's house, 13-year-old Kayleen. Crystal and Kayleen, 10 and 13. And the girls went to sleep that night in Kayleen's bunk bed. Kayleen was on the bottom bunk. Crystal was on the top bunk. At some point during the night, Crystal woke up from a loud noise in the room, almost like a thump. And she looked down from the top bunk, and Crystal saw a man standing in the room. This man was Tommy. Tommy had somehow managed to climb through the bedroom window into Kayleen's room. He then proceeded to pick up Kayleen from the bottom bunk bed, stood her up, and proceeded to cut her throat. She immediately fell to the floor and did not move again. Tommy then began to head towards the bedroom door when he heard a noise from the top bunk. Crystal had tried to keep her best to be quiet, but Tommy had spotted her. So he walked back over to the bunk beds, grabbed Crystal, and slashed her throat. Somehow, Holly, somehow, Crystal survived. The girl on the top bunk. After waiting for Tommy to leave, Crystal ran out of her friend's house and went to the closest neighbor's house. She was then able to write a message on a piece of paper that said, quote, "The Harrises are hurt. Please hurry," for the neighbors to read, because at this moment she was holding her throat, unable to speak.
Oh my gosh, poor kid.
10 years old. On the note, she also wrote, quote, "My neck needs help," and, quote, "Will I live?"
Oh my gosh, Kate, I can't.
Can you imagine?
That's actually so terrible.
And the fact that she was able to do all, just mind-blowing to me. Obviously, the neighbors called the police and whatnot, but yeah.
All that I was like, okay, yeah, he sounds like he could be the guy, but, you know, no kids. But just even knowing that he's willing to harm kids, like, now I can see it. Where it could be him.
Yeah. Well, and also the bludgeoning thing.
Yeah.
Like that's, yeah. Okay. So Crystal was taken to the hospital. The neighbors called the police and she was able to recover from her wound. And she worked with a forensic artist to help create a drawing of the man who had attacked her and Kayleen that night. And not even 24 hours after the drawing was released, they had Tommy Lynn in custody. Round of applause for Crystal, ladies and gentlemen. That is just a 10-year-old.
Crazy.
So on that New Year's Eve night, it turns out that Tommy had crawled through Kayleen's window, proceeded to stab her 16 times, then sexually assaulted her, which is what Crystal heard, and then killed her by cutting her throat. Investigators believe that Crystal, because Crystal was located on the top bunk, she was laying in a different position than Kayleen. So when Tommy went to cut Crystal's throat, it didn't go as deep just because of the motion. And therefore, Crystal was able to survive. While he was in custody, Tommy ended up confessing to over 70 different murders.
Wow.
Which, how do you even know that you did? Like, 70 is a number that, I mean, I don't even, when people confess to like 20, I'm like, how do you remember all those?
Yeah.
But 70. And in the end, investigators were able to actually prove that he had committed 22 murders. Like, they knew for a fact he did 22. They found evidence for it. Mm-hmm. But when he confessed these 70 murders, Tommy included the slaughter of the Dardeen family. The story that Tommy gave the investigators was that on November 17th, 1987, while he was hitchhiking, he was picked up by Keith Dardeen, who was heading to work, but he brought Tommy back to the trailer where his family was for dinner. While Tommy was at the home, he was asked by Keith and Elaine to have a threesome. Okay. Instead of having the threesome, which apparently offended him, he pulled out a gun and shot Keith twice in the head. He then proceeded to cut off his genitalia, you know, shove it in his mouth and shoot him one more time, just for funsies. Tommy then bludgeoned the 3-year-old Peter to death before attacking Elaine. And Tommy did tell the investigators that Elaine had gone into labor during the beating, and he sat there and watched her give birth before beating her and the newborn to death. The issue with his story, though, or more so with the possibility, like, did Tommy actually kill the Dardines, is that his story changed 5 times. And so we don't like inconsistency, you know. All of the stories, all 5 of the stories, were wildly different from each other. But
was he doing the same thing with the other murders he confessed to, or was he just unable to come up with?
We don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't know. But yeah, like, all of the 5 stories he said for the Dardians were completely different. But the first story is the one that I just read to you. So that's the first one that the investigators heard. One of the other stories, I will say, was that he was riding a train. He hopped off in Ina to stay the night somewhere. He saw the for sale sign in front of the Dardine trailer. He knocked on the door, told Keith he wanted to buy the house. Keith led him inside, and then he proceeded to carry out the murders. But in this version, in that version at least, and in all of the other ones, Tommy said that he raped Elaine, but we know that that didn't happen because of the autopsy. We know about this with a lot of murderers, in particular those who are serial killers. Some of them love to try to take credit for other people's events, even though they didn't have anything to do with it. You know, like, they were like, they just want to add it to their bucket list, basically. And in this case, a lot of people, you know, thought that's what Tommy was doing. Like, he gave details about 70 people. They were like, he's just taking credit for everybody.
Yeah, it's just like, how does he know all of this information? I just wonder, are the cops, like, letting him, like, know certain details of the crimes, or...
Like, you have to take in consideration that, at least from what I saw and from what was posted, Tommy had very specific details about the Dardines' murders that was not released to the public.
Okay, that makes a big difference.
Right, but we don't know how the police investigated Tommy, because you don't know what's going down in that room. And I mean,
that's so frustrating.
Wake up, America. Sometimes cops don't do the best, or investigators don't do the best when, or what they're supposed to in investigations and rooms. And sometimes they probe the person to admit to crimes that they didn't commit. Tommy could have been fed information about the case, and he just pieced shit together and made stories up, you know?
Yeah. And I feel like they probably thought that they were doing their job, you know, interrogating this person. But if you feed a criminal, you know, information that the public doesn't know, then you can't tell if they're lying or not.
No. And that was the whole issue with this. So at some point while he was in custody, Tommy was medically diagnosed with bipolar disorder, depression, and psychosis. And the psychosis kind of gets me, because that's a big trigger with a lot of serial killers. He would go on to tell the authorities that when he killed people, he would often do it while he was high. And that's because, quote unquote, he was addicted to the rush, and he liked to watch the eyes of the victims fade, because he knew that he was setting their souls free. Tommy also said that he, quote, Holly, this one is going to come into play, he enjoyed killing children so that they wouldn't have to ever endure the abuse that he went through as a child. So he pretty much thought that if he killed kids, he was actually saving them.
Yeah, something's wrong with this person.
Yeah, well, we know lots of stuff's wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
So with the Dardines' murders, after Tommy Lynn was in custody, it was known that he had confessed to the murders, like, it was public, but the police didn't have any physical proof that Tommy did it. There was no evidence from the crime scenes that would give them physical stuff to charge Tommy in court for the Dardine family. But then, get this shit. Apparently, because I said something earlier that now is not gonna make sense, the police never tested any of the DNA from any of the crime scenes from the Dardine family. So how do they know that there wasn't DNA evidence of Tommy in there?
Right.
They didn't have physical evidence because they didn't test anything. Nothing inside the trailer, nothing inside the family car, nothing in the field, nothing on the people or their clothes. And I mean, you didn't do your job.
They don't say why they didn't.
Okay. This is what the investigators in the police station and the sheriff said. Apparently it was, quote, too expensive to do, and that they had limitations within their department to conduct different tests without needing to. So, like, in this case, if they had found a physical evidence, they then would have done the DNA test, but they didn't do it. The baseball bat was there. The murder weapon was there.
Let me ask you a question that I think I already know the answer to. Did they then save the evidence to test later?
Of course they didn't.
Of course they didn't. What a dumb question.
Yeah. Why would they?
Yeah. Why would they?
Ugh. So it makes, I mean, the, like literally they said their excuse was if there was physical evidence, then they could test the DNA. There was physical evidence. There, the murder weapon was there.
Yeah.
Yeah. In 2000, 13 years after the Dardeen family massacre, Tommy Lynn was convicted of a murder not related to the Dardeens and was sentenced to death row. Now, obviously it's weird to say that Tommy was only convicted and charged of one murder, because they confirmed that he had killed 22 people. But in this case, the murder that they charged him with, they knew was going to get him the death sentence. So there was no reason to put the families and friends through the trials. But in my head, I would want that to be on the rap sheet. You know, like if you killed my mom or something and you're not going to get charged with it, I don't care. Yeah. You're going to go do the trial. I'm going to make sure you do it. 10 years after that, in 2010, Joanne, who was Keith's mom, requested to meet with Tommy in person at the prison. She said that by doing this, she would maybe get more closure about what happened to her son and the family's deaths. But when Tommy was given the request, he denied it. He said, literally, what would that do? In the end, Tommy Lynn was sentenced to death on January 3rd, 2014, and it was carried out by a lethal injection on April 3rd, 2014. So years and years after investigating and trying to figure out who the murderer or murderers were, the Dardeen family case went cold. There's nothing left for the police to investigate. They had no murder weapons other than the baseball bat. They had no DNA evidence. They had nothing. And as of January 2025, that's still how it is.
That's frustrating. I hate this case. Actually, I kind of like it and I kind of hate it. It's a love hate.
It is, because you're like, okay, Tommy did it. But did he?
Yeah.
Because his stories don't make sense with the values of the Dardeens. Like, there's no effing way they would have let a homeless man or someone that wanted to buy their house at 6:30 p.m. at night into their trailer.
Yeah. The only thing I could think of is if he, like, the railroad's right there.
Mm-hmm.
If he did, like, force his way into their home.
Yes. Like, what if Keith was leaving the house? Like, let's say Tommy, he got off the railroad. He's doing a stakeout at their house or their trailer in the woods. And he sees Keith leaving to go to work. And he knows, like, he takes the opportunity and the door is unlocked because Keith just walked out or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And just kind of carried it out from there.
Yeah. That's the only thing. I mean, obviously the killer had a gun. So it's like, did he force him, you know, into the car, he go kill him, he comes back and kills his whole family? Or I don't know. Yeah. I think that I do agree that they wouldn't just let someone like him inside, and they wouldn't just like pick up a, you know, hitchhiker. But I believe that he was the person that did it.
My only thing that, you know, to be the devil's advocate is the whole, like, it was such a personal thing. And that's what kind of throws me for a loop, is that if you remember at the beginning, I talked about how Keith started getting paranoid, and even his work people said he was paranoid. So, like, where did that come into play? You know, he started doing those security measures. He started getting paranoid. He thought someone was watching him.
No, that is weird.
You know, and then the whole, like, just the murders, the castration, the kids in the bed. That's so personal that I want to think it was Tommy, but it totally also could have been someone they knew.
But I also think that a killing like that may kind of be on par with Tommy's other killings. Like, obviously I haven't looked at all, but just the way you described him, just, you know, killing little kids, like, why, you know, other than just like you're sick and twisted, and then everything you do is sick and twisted. And then maybe that's why these look personal. I don't know. I'm with you.
Yeah.
I'm just, it's confusing. It's
the whole baby thing just threw me for a effing loop, man.
Yeah.
Can you imagine being the cops that saw that, or Keith's dad?
No, it's like they're a victim for life now from that.
Yeah, that's absolutely crazy. So, and that is the Dardeen family massacre.
Mm-hmm. Good job, Kate. I really liked your unsolved. You should do them more often.
I will not, but that one was a good one.
That was a really
serious
bad good one.
Yeah. You want to hop into overtime?
Let's hop into overtime.
In between the last episode and now, obviously New Year's happened. We had quite a few incidents in America that happened during New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. I thought I would give a little quick synopsis of both of them, but I'm also not going to tell you many details because there's not a lot out there. Like, it just happened, you know? So the first one happened in Kylie's beloved New Orleans. I'm pretty sure, wasn't it? It was on Bourbon Street. So the popular place to be, the drinking spot, especially for New Year's. New Year's and Mardi Gras there are like absolute chaos.
I bet. I can't imagine.
And around 3 a.m. on New Year's Day now, a man, a 42-year-old man, piled through Bourbon Street in a pickup truck that he had rented. He killed at least 15 people. He critically injured 30 more. And then in the end, he ended up dying in a shootout with the police. He did shoot both of the police officers, or shot two police officers. They are okay. They're not in critical condition. They'll be good, but that's still nuts. And then obviously they were able to shoot and kill him. And that's how it ended. Unfortunately, this was an act of terrorism, which we hate to see. Well, we hate to see any of it, but especially this. What I found very sad about this, and it obviously raises a lot of flags and people, you know, we need to talk about this more often too, is the man that did commit this attack. He was in the U.S. Army. He's 42 years old, and he had been based at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Shout out Fort Bragg, Fayetteville. Hate you. He had been in the Army for a long time, and in the back of the pickup truck when he drove down Bourbon Street was an ISIS flag that he was flying around. No bueno. I'm sure a lot will come out more of that story, but for now, I'm just going to kind of leave that one as it is. And then not only, what was it, 6 hours later, I think it happened, because it happened around 9 a.m. We're now in Vegas. It was Vegas, right?
Yeah, Vegas.
Yeah. A Tesla truck blew up outside of the Trump Hotel in Vegas. And it looked like right off the bat, what I heard was that there were explosions in the car. There was gasoline. It was definitely a terrorist attack. Like, they were trying to blow up the Trump building, stuff like that. But as the day continued, I actually was really passionate about watching this one in particular, the entire day. And it will kind of make sense after I tell you, but the man who died in the truck, we find out later on that it actually wasn't an act of terrorism. The man was in the U.S. Army as well, which is, you know, kind of threw people for a loop. He had also been stationed at Fort Bragg at some point. What is going on at Fort Bragg? We need to talk about that in another case. Yeah. Push comes to shove, there wasn't bombs in the truck. He had a few gas things in his trunk. He had driven from Colorado. He didn't want to have to stop at gas stations. It wasn't like as big of a deal as people made. He had a memoir written on his phone that they were able to find.
If it's a Tesla truck, doesn't it charge?
I don't know. Are Tesla trucks chargeable?
I think that's the, yeah. I think
all of them? Oh, I have no idea.
Yeah. I mean, if it's a Tesla.
Oh.
I don't know. Maybe there's hybrids. Wow. Just wondering.
Okay. You know, obviously Elon Musk right away was like, it's not the truck that exploded. It was a bomb. And well, I mean, it turns out it kind of was a bomb. He did purposely set off a bomb in the truck. This man, he shot himself before doing so and then blew up the truck. In the notes section of his phone that they were able to recover, basically they found all the evidence of this wasn't a terrorist attack. He had severe PTSD. He had been a U.S. Army Ranger of 18 years, which is crazy, nuts that this happened. And he basically said the United States needs to be aware of PTSD within soldiers and veterans, etc. Oh, okay. And then he said in the notes section, this isn't an act of terrorism. This is a wake-up call to America, which is really sad. But he talked about a lot of, with PTSD, and basically said like he just, it was too much for him. He was a very avid Trump fan. He was a raging Republican. He loved his country. So when people were like, he was trying to kill Trump, all this stuff, like, that's not what happened. I think he just picked the, I don't know why he picked the Trump place if he loved Trump, but he did. Fortunately, he did not kill anyone with the bombing. He did injure a few people that were outside and in the lobby, but they are all okay and none of them are in critical condition. Okay, so then the last one, and then we'll basically be done, is New Year's Eve. We're going to jump over to Hawaii. For those of you that don't know, my brother is in the U.S. military. He's in the Air Force, and him and my sister-in-law are stationed in Hawaii. He's a pilot. Well, let me just say this. Hawaii, actually, it's illegal to have or set off fireworks in Hawaii. So, like, totally banned. Absolutely not allowed. And New Year's Eve, I'll send you guys the video. The island was popping with fireworks. I mean, it was like the craziest thing. My brother sent me this video from their house, and it was just the whole island was fireworks shows. And it was really cool until I found out that it was completely illegal for everything. But unfortunately, during people setting off fireworks for New Year's Eve, family and friends gathered at a house in a neighborhood, just a random house in a neighborhood, and set off a firework that accidentally went sideways. And it launched into the other fireworks, and it caused a disastrous explosion in the house, on the street. Many people were killed. A lot of them were family members and the friends of the family members. And in the end, I think there's still like 20 people that are critically like burned. They said that people are up to 90% burned, which I can't even, being burned is like my worst fear. On the flip side of this, and this is coming into play with my brother now, is that my brother's a pilot. There were 6 individuals from this explosion that were in critical condition and needed to be in a burn unit and have surgeries. And apparently they did not have any more room at the burn unit in Hawaii. So they needed to fly these 6 individuals, medevac them to the closest, biggest burn unit hospital, which was in Arizona. And so these 6 individuals left yesterday morning from Hawaii and were sent to Arizona, and they flew on a C-17, which is the plane that my brother flies in the Air Force. And we found out this morning that my brother was one of the 2 pilots that flew the plane. So kind of a wraparound situation. Wow. We're really proud of Matt. Yeah. For doing that, you know. We assume he was off of work that day, so we assume that it was an on-call situation and he most likely volunteered as well. So kudos to you, Matthew, but hopes and prayers for those survivors. That was a horrible way to start the year. So hopefully it is all up from here. It for sure is going to be on our podcast. I promise you, we have lots of good things coming this year. 2025, let's be good. Do good things. Don't kill people. And with that, thank you for tuning in to another episode of Over My Dead Pod. If you want even more information about the case, check us out on our website at overmydeadpod.com. You can also find us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or X, whatever it's called, at Over My Dead Pod. And we will see you guys next week with another episode. Bye.
Bye.